If you were with us last week, you'll remember that we found Jesus then at a wedding, as a guest along with his disciples and with his mother, who seems to have been on the inside of the wedding arrangements, such that when the wine ran out unexpectedly, she felt it was falling to her to do something about it. And wisely she told her son about the problem, which was a habit presumably she had got into over the years, because Joseph, her husband, it would seem, had died much earlier. She was in the habit of bringing issues to Jesus, and so here is another one. And wonderfully and miraculously, Jesus meets the need of the moment. But even as he does so, he makes it plain to her that this is the point when he must begin to distance himself from merely family concerns and from the life of his home. From this point on, he is beginning to head for the cross, which he refers to as his hour. And he says to her, his hour has not yet come, but it will, and indeed it must, because he has come into a broken world in order to recreate and to rescue and renew that world. And that renewal is wonderfully illustrated by that first of the signs that John records for us, the turning of water into wine. Now, this incident in the second half of the chapter, it really could hardly be more contrasted, could it, with the first than it actually is. You remember the wedding took place in Cana. Cana is a nowhere sort of place, up in Galilee, nothing, no significance to it at all. The event was a private one. The whole village would have come, but it didn't go further than that. And what Jesus did at that time was so low profile that, of course, most people present had no idea that he'd done anything at all, let alone that he had turned water into wine and rescued them in a very embarrassing situation. More than that, the effect of what he did was received with relief and joy and gladness on all sides. And the wedding continued and glasses were raised and so on. Now, this incident in the temple could have hardly been more different. We're no longer in northern Galilee. We are now down in Jerusalem, and on center stage, the center of the country and of the national life. We're there at Passover time. Passover is the biggest feast of the year, and vast numbers, millions, would descend on Jerusalem for this greatest of the Jewish feasts. And unlike a secret turning of water into wine, what Jesus does here could hardly be more public. Everybody knew what was going on. And far from resulting in joy and gladness on every side, as happened at the wedding, there is consternation. And we might even be left wondering, and people might, therefore, if by any chance a wedding guest from Cana happens to be there, they might be asking, is this really the same man? I didn't know he was like this. Well, I think others who may possibly still have some distant memory of gentle Jesus, meek and mild, will read this story with interest. It's not the most inclusive of behaviors that Jesus goes in for here. The temple court is packed with noise and activity. Tremendous amount of noise. That's the thing you'd have noticed most. Hordes of people and animals and birds. And noise. And then you just see, if you're there, there's a commotion in the corner, and you wonder what is going on, and you look across, something certainly very unusual is happening, and then you hear the noise, huge quantities of coins being poured out and cascading onto the flagstones. You see tables being overturned, pigeons fly everywhere, oxen and sheep are being herded towards the exit along with the people who've brought them. And there are cries of astonishment and alarm and outrage. And you say, what on earth is going on? And you discover that it is all because of one man standing there with a whip of cords. That's not as violent as it sounds. It's almost certainly made from the rushes that were on the floor. It's not a weapon of any power, of any actual strength in itself. No, the authority of this man is a moral authority. He has no authority whatever to do what he is doing, other than the authority of his person, as he stands there and says, take these things away, and drives them out. And the Jews, that's the Jewish authorities in verse 18, not surprisingly, ask him what he's doing. What do you think you're doing, is how we might roughly rephrase verse 18. What sign do you show us for doing these things? What are you up to? Who said you could do this? And we may find ourselves asking the same. what is going on here. Now, John kindly records the answer to that question for us. He shows us here what really matters to Jesus as he arrives in the temple precincts. Here is a window in this strange and extraordinary narrative into the heart and mind of Jesus at this early stage of his ministry. What do we find here? What mattered to Jesus? First thing here is very plain. He has a deep reverence for God's house. A deep reverence for God's house. Verse 16, he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of trade. And his disciples remember that it was written in that earlier psalm, zeal for your house will consume me. Do not make my Father's house a house of trade. Now, we need to be clear, there's nothing wrong with trade. Jesus' parables often refer to trade. The master goes away, gives his servants some money, tells them to work hard and trade with what he gives them so there'll be something to show for it at his return. He tells the story of the merchant who dealt in pearls, buying and selling pearls until he found one of great price. There's nothing wrong with trade, and there's nothing wrong with this trade, which has two sides to it. There's the animal side, oxen, sheep and pigeons and things, and these were needed for sacrifices. Sacrifices were offered for a variety of reasons. Most acts and events in a Jewish family life would be marked by an appropriate sacrifice. You think of Joseph and Mary when Jesus is born and going, because they were not well off, taking just a couple of pigeons with them to the temple. So you needed these things. You needed oxen and sheep and pigeons for the sacrifice. And if you'd come to Jerusalem for the Passover from a long way, if you'd come from Jericho down in the south or Dan up in the north, it'd be a bit of a pain to have a drag of sheep all the way with you. Much more convenient to be able to buy one there. And sure enough, you get there and you can buy. And you have the added advantage that these people will be absolutely sure that their animal specimens are flawless, because, of course, only flawless specimens could be offered in sacrifice. So the animal side is necessary. And the money changers, they are necessary too. Every adult male Jew over 19 years had to pay the temple tax each year, paid half a shekel, it was a couple of days' wages. And the paying of the temple tax maintained the sacrificial worshipping life of the temple. It seems strange to us, but it was absolutely central to Jewish culture at the time. Now, in normal trade in Israel, normal business dealings up and down the land, any old currency would do, and lots of different currencies were used. But the money paying the temple tax is going to go into the temple treasury. And a Roman coin, for instance, would have the image of the emperor, Caesar. And Caesar was semi-divine. And to use that kind of coinage to pay the temple tax was not acceptable. Touch of blasphemy. And so the money changers were very useful as well. You bring your money and you change it for stuff that would be acceptable. So the sellers of oxen and the money changers are very necessary in their own way. They're offering a service. It is probably true that some of them were making a bit more than they should have, one or two much more than they should have. But we're not told that here. And we shouldn't read that into the story when John does not tell us that that is the case. We're probably going to miss the point. What is the point? As Jesus says, take these things away. Don't make my Father's house a house of trade. His point is that they shouldn't have been doing it there. In Father's house, for which he has a deep reverence. It's probably in the outer court, the Gentile court of the temple. But the animals and the coinage were the mechanics of the temple system. They were necessary to keep it going. And as the New Testament later tells us, in the daily offering of sacrifice for sin was a reminder that these sacrifices could never work. But they had to be maintained. And trouble is that the mechanics here have become the main thing, when they were only ever meant to be a means to an end. As I say, the trade was doubtless in the outer court, the court of the Gentiles. That was as close as non-Jews were allowed to come. And if you came as a Gentile, suppose you'd come from a long way away, you should have had some sense of the presence of God in the place that you came into. And instead, if you'd come in through the gates, you'd have been met with this great racket. You would have been able to hear yourself think, let alone pray. The temple was a very, very fine building, but what made it special was not its architecture, but the fact that God had promised to be there. That's the significance of the temple. That is why it was known as God's house, uniquely as God's house. No other building could ever or should ever be called God's house. It was uniquely true of the temple in Jerusalem. A church building, such as we are in this morning, is a building, a rain shelter, as an Aussie friend of mine calls it, and not much more. It's very useful because we can meet and we don't get wet. But that's all it is. A friend of mine who's been in Christian ministry for many years was telling me just recently of a time when, as a teenager, he wrote a postcard at the back of a church. And he then felt terrible about what he'd done. His conscience was deeply smitten. He felt that this was terribly disrespectful, and it wasn't even during a church service. It was just in the building. He wrote a postcard, and he felt that he had desecrated the house of God. Oh, mercifully, somebody explained to him this was all he'd done was write a postcard. Why shouldn't you write postcards? Now, a building is just a building, but this building was different. The New Testament knows nothing of holy places and holy buildings. All it knows about is holy people who meet together, often in a building. And this temple that in which this scene takes place is not the original one, of course. As the Jews say, this one they've been building for 46 years, but it is still the place to which God has summoned his people and where he has promised to meet with them. And they had entirely lost sight of that, and that is what gets Jesus' ire. The mechanics of worship had moved center stage. The God-ordained sacrificial system had to be kept going, but God himself had been pushed to the side, even perhaps for some out through the back door. And so when Jesus arrives, he is confronted with this noisy tumult, all the paraphernalia of worship when God himself is no longer in people's minds. And it clearly happened then, and it can happen today. You remember the words of Isaiah that Jesus quoted on a different occasion? This people worship me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. What a danger for a Christian gathering. I want to ask myself, do I love Jesus more than I did 12 months ago? Is that true of you and me? And it's possible for folk to get together and hymns and songs to be sung and notices given and prayers prayed and the Bible opened, but people's hearts are not engaged. More concerned, perhaps, about looking up the property page of the Sunday paper a little later on than in having dealings with the living God. And passion is an overused word, isn't it, these days? But it's really what Jesus, well, what the disciples remember in the word from the psalm. Zeal, passion for your house will consume me. It's an overused word. We're all meant to be passionate about it. Things, some young people have to prove to get a job. They're passionate about wanting to do it and so on. But if it is an overused word, it certainly applies to Jesus. Zeal for your house will consume me. Passionate concern for the glory of God and revulsion against merely human activity which gets in the way. So that's the first thing. We see this window into the heart of the Saviour as John records it. A deep reverence for God's house. His second great concern here is for the rebuilding of that house. The rebuilding of the temple. And even as Jesus clears it out in this kind of sort of prophetic enactment, he knows that its days are numbered. It is corrupt and it is actually beyond repair. However many times he clears people out, it is doomed. That happens to things, doesn't it? It happens to smaller things. I have had a favourite pullover, which I've worn for many years, but the time came when there were more holes in it than pullover, and the comment from the family was, "Dad, you really can't wear that anymore." So it came on holiday with us and did a very good job, but I have not worn it since return. Things, useful things, do lose their usefulness. And on a far bigger scale, the temple was wonderfully useful, but its time has come. It needs to be rebuilt, and as some of us have been involved, if you've been involved in an extension or your home or whatever, you'll know that it's costly for one thing and disruptive for another. And so it is in this case. And Jesus says that the rebuilding of the temple will take place in three stages. And he's speaking, obviously, not literally all the way through. The first stage, though, is a literal one, and it's as sad as it is surprising. The first stage in the rebuilding is that the temple will destroy him, which may seem a very strange idea, that the temple will destroy him. But that is the meaning of that quote in verse 17. Zeal for your house will consume me means not only that I will be passionate about it, it also means it will be my downfall. Zeal, my passion for this house will actually result in my own destruction, in my downfall. You see, this is the beginning, this is early days in Jesus' active public life. And the Jews are not, they're caught on the back foot here. This is all new and unexpected, and for the moment he gets away with it because of the element of surprise and maybe popular support and his huge moral authority. But much later, near the end of the story, he'll do it again. And that time the temple authorities will be ready, and it's not long before they hound him to death. You see, his passion for the house of God, for the glory of God, will actually destroy him because his enemies will rise up from within the temple. The people who should have known so much better. The temple will actually destroy him. The second stage is that God will destroy the temple, which is what verse 19 is referring to, where Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple." Destroy this temple, meaning, when this temple is destroyed, as of course it was only a generation or so later. That building, that magnificent building, was largely reduced to rubble, and you can still see some of the stones left in Jerusalem where they fell after destruction by the Romans. In the early 1800s, Tsar Alexander I of Russia built a magnificent cathedral next to the Kremlin as a sign of gratitude to God for victory over Napoleon. A magnificent building, the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, built, I don't know, quite in 1815, 1820, something like that. A little over 100 years later, in 1931, Joseph Stalin blew it up. And it was a desperately sad moment. You can see pictures of this magnificent building just crumbling into the dust. It was very, very sad. It was an outrage, of course. But at the end of the day, that's all it was. Very, very sad, the loss of a very fine building. But for God to destroy the temple is different, because this is destroying his own house. Which of us has ever destroyed his own house? But Jesus looks ahead to that day, destroy this temple and things will follow. And he will destroy it. Why will he destroy it? Because his own people will have rejected their own Messiah, namely Jesus. And to destroy the Messiah is to call down a terrible judgment on those who do it. Destroy this temple, the second stage. First of all, the temple, as it were, the authorities of the temple will destroy him. Secondly, later, God will destroy the temple in a terrible act of judgment. But that is not the end, because the third stage is this. And this probably seems very strange, if you're not familiar with it. It's that Jesus will then become the temple. Well, if the other thought was strange, this is stranger still, isn't it? How can a human being become a building? Destroy this temple, says Jesus, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Now the Jews, puzzled, said, "What on earth are you talking about? Will you raise it up in 3 days when it took us 46 years to build it?" And he says, but they realized that he was speaking about the temple of his body. "When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this." See, the old temple had limitations even in its heyday. It was the place of God's promised presence, but it wasn't big enough. I always love the story of the little girl in Sunday school. We'd been to a Sunday school class. She went back home. She spoke to Mummy and said to Mummy, Mummy, is God everywhere? And Mummy said, yes, darling. And she said, is he in our house? Yes, darling. Is he in this room? Slightly cautiously, yes, darling. Is he in this mug here? Yes, darling. Hands on top, got him. And on a much bigger scale, of course, now she couldn't really contain God in a mug. The people could not contain God in the temple. And when it was consecrated, right back in Old Testament days, King Solomon, who built it and consecrated it, even as he prayed, the prayer at the time of consecration, said to the Lord, O Lord, heaven and the highest heavens cannot contain you, how much less this building that I have built. Solomon knew that he couldn't fit God into God's house, into the temple. And now the temple has gone. Where can we go? Where could the people go? Where can we go to meet with God? Answer is, we come to Jesus. The old temple wasn't big enough for God to dwell there, but Jesus is. He knows no such limitations. In him, the whole fullness of deity dwelt bodily. And he replaces the temple and becomes the meeting place where men from north, south, east and west, women, children, all of humanity can meet with the living God. The temple sacrifices, as we know, never dealt with human sin. Only the death of the Messiah, at his hour, could do that. And it's a strange and wonderful thing which believers will ponder for eternity, that it is actually the rejection of the Saviour that becomes the means of our salvation. Such is the wisdom of God. The disciples didn't get it then, but they did later. When he was raised from the dead, his disciples remember that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. They understood they didn't need the temple anymore, because all they needed was Jesus. Now, in Jerusalem today, you can go down, and I had the great privilege of doing this in April this year, you can go down below the temple where they've excavated the foundations. It's a fascinating thing to do. Of course, the temple itself is long since gone, but the foundations are there. And the stones that were used were vast. We were told that it was true that one of them that we were looking at weighed more than 200 elephants. Well, I can't get my head around that, but even if it's weighed more than one elephant, it's big enough for me. And you can walk along next to these vast foundation stones, knowing that up above, through the ground, in an earlier day, the temple itself was up above. And I remember squeezing along this little passageway lit along these great foundation stones, and just coming up against a woman in her 30s, I should think, who was pressed against this great stone. Her hands pressed against it, her whole body pressed against it, and she was praying silently, quietly, all on her own down there. And we thought, why is she here? What is she doing down here praying like this? And the answer was that that is the place today where she could get nearest to what used to be the center of the temple and the Holy of Holies. Only really a matter of yards up above. Not there anymore, but it's where it used to be. And she so wanted to be in the very presence of God that she came and pressed herself on the stone as near as she could get. But of course he wasn't there. And I wanted to reach out as I was going past and say, my dear, you don't have to do this. And anyway, it doesn't work. All you need to do is come to Jesus. He is the real temple in which we meet with the Lord. He himself said, all that the Father gives me will come to me. And the one who comes to me, I will never, ever turn away. So Jesus has a deep passion for the glory of God and reverence for his house. But that house has got to be rebuilt. In fact, replaced, as he himself will become the new temple. And the third thing, very briefly, which is just touched on at the end, is that we find here his deep concern for the renewing of the human heart, because that's what it's all about. When he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them, because he knew all people. There needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. You see, many believe in his name when they see the signs. Interestingly, Jesus did lots of signs, and John's only recorded 7. And you might think, all these people think, we're believing in Jesus. You might think, this is great, he's getting somewhere. The beginning of popular support, maybe of a mass movement. But it's not what Jesus thinks. He did not entrust himself to them. He knew what was in people. You see, this response, this supposed belief, is a superficial thing from these folk. It won't stand the test of time. They're intrigued. They want to know more. They're struck by this man and his actions, but they don't yet have any idea what following him will actually mean. And they're certainly not ready for a deep change of heart and life. And therefore Jesus does not entrust himself to them, because nothing less than that will do. You remember the water into wine at Cana, all about recreation, not just improvement, not mixing the water with a little something or other, but total recreation. And Jesus didn't come to tell us to be nice, because he knew that we aren't nice. He came to recreate us and remake us, and nothing less than recreation.